From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Germ warfare is Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
germwarfare@tntradio.live is my email address. Send me a message, question, feedback, whatever. I don't mind. Thank you to everybody who has been emailing me. I'm glad that you enjoy my show. I just facilitate great guests. Thank you to Laurie. Appreciate your message. To Martin, appreciate it. Jamie, oh, it just goes on and on and on. I can't reply to everybody. But I will, I'll try and make an effort to reply to some of the good emails. So if you make your email quality, I'll try and respond accordingly. Please download the TNT app. It's in the Google and Apple store. That means you can listen to any TNT show whenever you want. As I said before, I really do enjoy that because, you know, time zones are a bane sometimes. You know, I want to listen to John O'Sullivan, but, you know, his show is just at some ridiculous hour. You know, I'm already sleeping. So it's a great thing about listening to his show via the app. And I'm going to be chatting in a moment to Mike Eden. Really excited. Mike has an incredible story, actually. I mean, such a journey. And I am a big fan of storytelling. I'm less interested in the academia, and I'm more interested in the storytelling. And Mike has such a great story, and I think I'm going to get to him right now. My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare on TNT Radio.
News you can count on.
They break down the big story.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Mike Eden, thank you for joining me in the trenches. How are you?
I'm very well. Good morning, good afternoon. Thank you for letting me use your platform to reach yet more people.
Mike, it's not about using my platform. It is sharing in the knowledge. It's a great privilege to be able to chat to you. It's the other way around.
Well, as I say, people, they probably know who I am. I'm only talking out because the worst crime of humanity is underway. And although I'm 62 and don't really care that much, or I'm fed up that they've stolen my retirement that I worked hard for and my wife's, I'm most concerned about the world for my young adult children and their children. And that's the only reason I'm speaking out. I do think I've got an unparalleled set of credentials that should make what I say believable. You've only got two choices, folks, who are hearing me. You either think I've completely lost my mind, or I'm still the same scientist I was, and everything I tell you is to the depths of my soul and my intellect correct. And so when I tell you some of the things I'm telling you, if you choose not to do anything with that information, you will go into the mincer too, and there's nothing I could have done about it. But I don't make a cent. I'm not interested in publicity. And I left my former employer 11 years ago on excellent terms. So all the things people have said, oh, he must be, you know, an embittered ex-employee or on the grift or likes the fame, all that's BS. And what I just told you is absolutely true. Mm.
Well, I've been in communication with you, I think, since about 2020, Mike. And in my mind, you're one of the greatest scientists in the world. And I was saying to my previous guest, Mark Bailey, that a true scientist, somebody who is genuinely into critical thinking, is willing to change his mind or his position based on new evidence or better evidence. It's not about arrogance or self-importance.
No, you're right. I did chat to, it was in touch with the Baileys and others in 2020, I think, and they told me their what seemed to me an unbelievable story about corruption in the world of virology. And I have to say, by the end of about an hour, I did concede you've completely shaken my confidence in what I thought I knew, but I'm not ready to go all the way down the rabbit hole with you because I can't answer equally good questions that immediately arise, you know, a bit like transmission and so on. But, you know, but I will credit them. They never bothered me again, not once. But the worm of the idea kept going round and round and round. And as those who've heard me will realize that earlier this year, I came to the firm conclusion that if SARS-CoV-2 exists at all, then it is not contributing to illness and death. I'm absolutely certain of that now. And probably you've interviewed the person who produces the the data that makes that unequivocal. And any scientist hearing me who insists that the virus is going around, but it's not as dangerous, is so go and look at the data. Because one of the things that's made me almost want to quit is that people I know who know that we're being lied to, for example, misuse of PCR tests, inappropriate application of non-pharmaceutical interventions like lockdowns that are smashing the economy. These people and the vaccines don't work and are dangerous, right? I know 20 or 30 people, clever people, who know all of those things are, they're all fake. But when I outline to them that, you know what, they've even lied to us about the presence of a new pathogen, I would say, you know, 90% don't believe me and 10% attack me furiously. And that was the thing, folks, if you've been doing it, that has pushed me to the point of thinking, you know what, if I cannot even bring with me people who know that 90% of what I've said is absolutely true and that we're being lied to, if when I explain the reasons why another piece from the same people that lied to you about everything else is also a lie, then, you know, I might as well quit because I'm not going to get any new people over the line and we'll end up, I'm very worried that we'll end up with, you know, we'll all fight lots of different battles, all of them the old one. And I hope we'll get to it in this conversation. But I'm pretty sure, and I won't be alone in thinking that the battlefront in this war is moving. And if we keep fighting the last war, we will lose. So it won't be about COVID in a year's time, I don't think.
The scientist to whom you are referring is Denis Rancourt from Canada.
That's the one. Yeah, he's a good guy. A lot of people find him awkward, but that's possibly why I think his data is so trustworthy. He won't flex at all when you try and summarize back, and it's like, no, that's not right. And his papers are impenetrable, 100 and something pages. But I'll just tell the story very briefly then. So,
yes,
like most people, I thought there was a virus initially. It never occurred to me in perhaps January 2020 that we're being lied to. So it's a bit of a mistake, really, that I didn't come back to this one and pick this dropped stitch up until far later. So, yeah, I thought there was a virus because you don't expect everybody to be lying to you all at once. But I realized, for example, with the misuse of the polymerase chain reaction, which is not a test, by the way, as its inventor was keen to tell us, it's not a test, it's a process, and it amplifies things. So I knew by summer of 2020 that the test wasn't worth using. And so one by one, I realized everything they were telling us was a lie, that the apparent lethality associated with people becoming symptomatic was far less. And we always knew it would. Every new pathogen that arrives, let's think about it, folks. You see the sickest people. They rock up at the hospital and obviously a fraction of them die. What you're not seeing is the people who've got this same thing but aren't so ill, or these people who've got this thing and are not symptomatic at all. And so when you start dividing the number of, quotes, cases with deaths, the infection fatality ratio falls and falls and falls. So I remember doing a little scribble graph, even assuming the narrative was correct about the virus. And I predicted in maybe June 2020, I said the infection fatality ratio will converge. It'll fall asymptotically. It'll be the same as flu. It is flu. You know, it's the same. It represents the same population threat. So don't get cross with me. Yes, it's not flu, but it represents the same population threat and to the same people, bar children, who don't seem to die at all. So I barreled through the year. By the end of 2020, I realized with mounting horror that there wasn't just exaggeration going on. The whole thing is a lie. For example, the imposition of lockdowns. I mean, I knew that was just mad. But by later in the year, I realized why it was mad, because staying with the narrative for a moment, the idea of transmitting a pathogen without having any symptoms. As a biologist, I knew that was between implausible and impossible, because to be a good source of infection, you have to have a lot of virus in your airway. to have a lot of virus in your airway will be associated with symptoms. There's no possible alternative. And so you can't have vigorous, you cannot have it. I'm the only person that's explained it like this, despite having spoken to dozens of people, but that's true. So, I mean, now I don't no longer believe that pathogen, I'm really not sure about respiratory pathogens, but I'll stick to what I know is not true, and that's SARS-CoV-2 is not causing mass illness and deaths. And we know this why. We know that traditionally in the Northern Hemisphere, all-cause mortality rises through the winter, does the same in the opposite end of the year, of course, in the Southern Hemisphere. And we've attributed it to respiratory viruses. That's probably not true, but it's good enough. And in England, in UK, for example, instead of daily deaths hovering around 1,800 per day, it goes to maybe 2,300 a day. So it's quite a big difference between, say, January, February, and June, July. And we've associated with influenza-like illnesses. I will stick with that. Influenza-like illnesses is generally how they're described. And that's what tends to mount in the winter. Now, guess what? It's in the elderly and already ill, massively disproportionately. Yes. And so if you look at all-cause mortality in the winter, it rises, doesn't just rise by the same percent in every age group. It rises a little bit in the 60-year-olds, more in the 70-year-olds, much more in the 80s, and the 90s often just don't make it. So you get this super proportional increase in all-cause mortality in the winter in the Northern Hemisphere. That has been seen every year it's been measured. And some states it's been measured like 150 years, but everywhere it's been measured, all-cause mortality rises in that way every year. And so guess what? When Dennis Rancor and his colleagues in Canada started looking at all-cause mortality, because then there's no dispute about what they died of. So unless the state governments are hiding dead bodies, they had a count of the sex, the age, and the date they died. And Dennis's team has plotted this week by week patiently for 100 weeks. And never has there been this, what I call a respiratory lethality signature. It is missing, Jeremy. It's missing.
Yes.
And what that tells you, is whatever it was that killed these people, it was not something similar to other, quotes, influenza-like illnesses. And once you've gone over that paper, folks, you can't hide from it. Stop going back to saying, well, if the virus this and that, there's no evidence for it causing illness and death. It can circulate if it likes. I don't care. It could circulate as a marker. So maybe there's a marker of something that's being picked up. I'm not saying that's not happening, but I am saying, and this is the final thing really, not everything is a lie, including there being a new public health hazard. There never was a new public health hazard. The only thing that was ever a public health hazard was your government's policy responses and the media and tech companies who have poured Project Fear out of every single output and into every orifice of every person on the planet that they can reach. And that itself alone will cause death, believe it or not. It's the most established cause of suppression of the immune system. It's chronic, acute on chronic stress and fear. So basically, I used to say in 2020, to reach out, your old life is immediately at arm's length. You can, there it is. You can just go and take it back today. Mm. But I will say now, go and hug a granny, hug a stranger, if you've got a mask on, God help you, you don't need masks. Masks are not filters. They never filtered anything. They just stopped in potentially infected fluids entering the mouth and nose of a medical worker. That's what they were used for. That's what they're useful for. They're not necessary in surgery. They're sometimes worn in surgery almost because people think they ought to, but there were a whole series of operations done by brave young surgeons in the Royal College of Surgeons maybe 20 or 30 years ago when this was at issue, and over several thousand relatively minor surgeries. I don't think they did any major surgeries without masks, but then they looked at the ones that had blue medical masks. Those teams were compared with the ones that didn't, and at the end there's no difference between them in terms of post-operative infections or outcome after recovery. If anything, with slightly fewer infections than the people without masks. So, so those of you who say, "Well, if it's good enough for doctors, I'm going to ignore you, Eden." So they don't wear them to reduce infection, and they don't do that. So they're not filters; they're splash guards. Anyway, so in the autumn of 2020, I reached a horrifying conclusion that since everything is a lie, and all the countries I could see were all lying to their people at the same time, that implied a supranational organization of some kind. When I say organization, I mean the arrangement, the coordination between them. So, you know,
yes.
I'm not saying it was the World Economic Forum. I've no idea. Maybe it was the WHO or some group we don't know about. But the point is, within a few days of each other, all governments were saying pretty much the same thing at the same time to their people.
Exactly.
Including things like 3 weeks to flatten the curve, when I've just told you, you know, and cleverer people than me realized there never was a novel pathogen. So guess what? What would be the most predictable effect of what that would do to the economy? And it would be to lower the rate of transactions. Now that means
yes.
The people who own the most assets, you know, money, businesses, you know, and real estate and so on, they're the ones whose their net worth's going to take a hit. So given this is obviously and provably a global event, those people who arranged this must be in touch with the people who are the movers and shakers. And they must have put a proposition to them and they must have said, okay, because that was the only effect. The only effect was to smash the economy and civil society. And at this point, I'm getting to realize that within days of the virus arriving, we had everybody talking about build back better. And I remember mentally scratching yes. my ear and thinking, well, but nothing's broken yet. What do you mean build back better? But anyway, so by the end of the year, I realized that there's a supranational plot to destabilize civil society and the economy everywhere, and to remove people's freedoms with a view to what? Making them roll their sleeves up and be injected with something that was obviously, well, and it's become worse. And it's like, well, and anyway, so here we are where the world is
Mike,
being taken over by lunatics.
I want to continue with that train of thought, but I just quickly want to cut to a break and then I'll be back with you in a moment.
You should hear what Jason Allbourn is talking about.
On Sky News just yesterday, Paul Murray came out with a story talking about how in Australia, our children have never had higher levels of depression and anxiety in this country. And Murray was asking his guests, how is it? Never had more wealth. We're in peacetime. I don't know where he got that one from. And why is that our kids feel this way? Well, doctor will tell you diet and exercise helps, but it's not the same for every individual, of course, is it? Because as we know, also sports people can get depressed too. And medication will not make one vital. Neither does indoctrination in schools, the bastion of forced monoculture, nor does hearing ad nauseum that the price of housing is out of reach. And that breeds hopelessness. Mum and dad spend their lives trying to pay off their house before they retire and die. How could that ever motivate anyone, any child, to believe that housing prices are astronomically going up exponentially? And I'm meant to compete. I don't know anything, and I've got to go out there and find a career and a job and rest. And it's all getting too hard. No wonder the kids feel the way they do.
Jason Allbourn and Jason Q. Citizen on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
On the day that he was inaugurated, the Washington Post had an article on impeaching him.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
Donald J. Trump is now president of the United States.
They had an absolute legitimate meltdown.
If you try to change a system that big, the system fights back.
The story behind the biggest election takeover in history.
We're only now being able to finally confirm exactly how this worked.
Mark Zuckerberg and his wife are donating more money to local governments ahead of the election. $100 million on top of a $300 million gift.
The most money any individual has ever spent to win a presidential campaign in the history of our country.
I actually became infuriated that someone had allowed Zuckerberg to tip the scale.
The election was bought way before Election Day.
They stole it fair and square. They changed the voting rules in the middle of the game.
A nation divided.
This was the greatest
billionaire assault on election integrity we've ever seen.
A billionaire-funded plot against the president.
Do you believe that they used the COVID emergency as an excuse to pull this partisan voter turnout operation?
Am I allowed to give you a one-word answer? Yes.
Rigged.
It was a rigged election. People have to find out what happened.
At SalemNow.com.
In 2018, 2.9 million people died of the flu and pneumonia. In 2020, there was a 98% decline in influenza, but 2.8 million die of COVID. Data never lies. We mandate that the truth be told. TNT Radio.
Mike, my apologies for interrupting. It's the nature of live radio. And just to let you know, I have to go to the news headlines in 5 minutes and then we'll have a smoother conversation after that. I just ran a little bit over time now with the last ad break, if you don't mind being interrupted a second time.
No problem. No problem. I should try and watch out.
I agree with you. Everything that you're saying, I mean, I'm completely there. You're preaching to the choir, but it baffles me. Yes. Mike, how people don't join these dots. You know, back in 2020, I think there was a three-day difference between South Africa and the UK going into national lockdown. And They used the president's British Prime Minister used the same terminology even as our president. That is not coincidence.
No. It's a script.
Yeah,
the whole thing is scripted. I mean, just I won't use up a lot of time, but those who have not yet seen it, I think it's still there. There's a YouTube 1 hour documentary by a German investigative journalist called Paul Schreier, surname S-C-H-R-E-Y-E-R. Title is Pandemic Simulations, Preparation for a New Era, ? And that video takes you through 25 years of international pandemic planning. So when I say is obviously planned, when I say it's obviously planned, not only is it obviously planned, just empirically, just looking around, you can go and find the official records of quotes them rehearsing it. I recommend people do that.
Yeah, well, the thing is this, is that event 201 is already a clue with regards to SARS. And what people don't realize is These people who were planning this stuff were literally telling us. They were telling us, and nobody blinked an eyelid.
No, and it's a good point. And again, awareness of time. I've learned that it's unwise to dismiss.
You know, Mike, when people in power, in very influential positions, tell you what they're going to do, it's probably a good idea to listen, don't you think?
I totally agree.
Yeah.
Yes.
I know that you're holding out for the news headlines. I'm just wondering, Luke, do you think we can just cut to that so I can have a longer chat with Mike?
Oh no, do you know what? If you don't want to do that, so maybe I'll let you answer, but if not, I've got a couple of fills.
Because I don't want to break you. Yeah, I don't want to break you in the middle of your flow.
Just, one of the things that's occurred to me is it's just how easily even people like me, I mean, I used to be a complete normie. Yeah, I've told people in the past, I believed it. I pretty much believed everything was in the history books and pretty much everything the BBC told me. I would occasionally snort at obvious kind of errors. But I generally was like comfortable midstream person. But now I know that all of this to do with this pandemic is a lie. I'm not even sure pandemic's possible, by the way, and I can explain why I say that. But it's like I even believe that the Nord Stream pipeline has blown up. And I was sitting here preparing for this conversation, and I thought, is that true? And when people snort and go, of course it's true, it's like, really? I mean, it might be blown up. I definitely can get to conclusions as to why perhaps the Americans will blow it up. But maybe it's not blown up. Is food really in short supply? We know electricity prices have gone through the roof and fresh. Yes. And I remember being told about a month ago that fresh food was being bulldozed back into the fields. And I said to my wife, there should be no fresh food in 4 weeks' time. But the shops still seem to be full. And I'm asking myself, are they lying to us even about this? You know, that's what goes through my mind. You can't trust anything, even when they tell you disaster and you think, oh, well, they wouldn't lie about that. You know, yeah, they will. And so both those things might be real. I'm just saying, be questioning about everything. It's quite disconcerting.
Okay, I'm going to unpack that a little bit with you, Mike, after the news headlines. So let me just quickly get to that now. I'll be back with you now.
Matt Boylan here with a look at your TNT headlines. North Korea has carried out its fourth weapons test in a week after launching another two ballistic missiles into the Sea of Japan. Russia's parliament will vote to formally annex four Ukrainian regions on Monday after President Vladimir Putin signed off on their accession to the Russian Federation. And it's been revealed Washington's chief medical officer almost doubled his net worth during the pandemic.
Do you have a suggestion for a possible guest or host that you'd like to hear on TNT Radio?
Or perhaps you have a topic you feel we should discuss?
Then we want to hear from you. Simply complete the suggestion form on the TNT Radio website. Help us make a difference on TNT Radio.
Mike, okay, so now anybody worth their salt would realize that there is something nefarious going on. How do you... In your mind, navigate this fog of propaganda?
Well, with difficulty is the honest truth, because, you know, as I say, I was preparing for this and I realized I wasn't even sure if the things I thought were definitely true, like Nord Stream pipeline. It probably has been blown up, but maybe it hasn't. I mentioned this to somebody in the Antipodes and they said, you know, I've just gone onto the spot market and gas is down, you know, and it's like, how can that possibly be if the supply has just been cut? And yet the domestic crisis, for example, of electricity have been, I think, raised threefold in Britain, maybe fivefold in France. So what I'm certain is, regardless of the actual truth of the cause of the increase in prices, the goal is to impoverish people, because even like comfortably off pensioners or whatever, they can just cover their bills. I remember my sister, for example, said, you know, if the price of electricity goes up fivefold, I won't be able to afford to eat. I will lose my house. So, you know, people who you think would be fine if they don't do anything stupid, everybody who's there and worse off will be at the mercy of the state. And since, when you look at the UN 2030 Sustainable Development Goals, they have a vision of us living in, as it were, rabbit hutch style large buildings. Is this the purpose of this? Is rather than freezing people to death, is the purpose to impoverish everybody affected by this, so that they will be willing to house share? Initially, they would house share with their best off friend with the largest house, but eventually they would. You can imagine libraries will be warmed up and town halls will be warmed up, and you have thousands of people milling in and out. Is that the objective? So, you know, you asked me the question. I suppose I navigate by constantly thinking about what is this about, because I'm going to try and use my scientific expertise. Of course, this last bit's not science, but it's using the scientific method to try and intuit and draw conclusions about where it's going, so you can just about get ahead of the traffic and flag people down. But yeah, I feel very low. You can probably tell, after giving nearly 80 interviews, it's
ideal. I like this comment of yours, Mike. I like this comment. You said, things we cannot check are all candidates for strategic or tactical lying.
Yeah, that's one of the conclusions, is you can't trust anything. And so, for example, I just don't think you can't trust the medical profession anymore. I'm sure there are lots of wonderful doctors and nurses, many of whom have behaved appallingly. But nevertheless, if they're willing to inject you or your child, having said to a colleague, I'm not going to inject any of my children with that shit, it's toxic, and then they'll literally go back in the office and inject your children. I know of people who've done that. It's just, personally can't understand it. I cannot understand it. I remember saying early on, you know, I retired at 57. I was lucky to. I could have stayed working for longer and made much more money, but I didn't care. So what about doctors who've earned well and they're in the mid to late 50s? You don't need to earn another penny, pal. You don't. So any of you that stayed on because you got to keep your job, you're lying to yourself. You've chosen to injure people instead so that you can get more money. That's what you've done. And I'm afraid I know lots of them. And I will never, ever, ever trust them again to prescribe me an aspirin. I will work it out for myself, even if I don't succeed, because I so don't trust the medical profession. And I worked training and working 41 years around on the periphery of this, you know, in drug discovery, and that's where I now am. And I don't think it's recoverable for me.
Mike, how broken is medical science?
worse than we can possibly believe. So I'll just tell a brief story. When I came into academia as an undergraduate in 1981, did my PhD 85 to 88, at that time most people in Britain that I knew of were funded by the Medical Research Council or a not very political Wellcome Trust mostly. And so whilst there were big sort of government themes, I don't think they were taken particularly seriously. They were still arguing about whether they should do blue sky research and hope miraculous things come out, or whether they should direct, you know, using public money to direct science in particular ways. And I think the latter, they realized they didn't even know what they wanted. So good academics, if they put forward a good grant application, could, you know, had a good chance of winning it, even if it was a controversial subject. But by the time I left pharma in 2011 and went into biotech, it was no longer true. You should not take as read even editorials, abstracts of papers, reviews. I'm afraid so. Don't quote them to me, folks. They're often lies, just literally lies. Now, unfortunately, I'm sure the majority of it's still pretty honest stuff. But the difficulty is, I can't tell which 10% is lies. And so I'm glad I've retired now. I could not do my job anymore because I've no faith in the scientific journals, because clinical trials are bent. Key opinion leaders will be like the most senior academics, maybe a research-based consultant physician. So they both practice but also give lectures. These people alter how treatment guidelines are written. They're always going to be on the committees of these things. And either they or someone from their research team will always be on the three-letter agencies, you know, FDA and so on. So unfortunately, over time, these individuals have been induced, they've been corrupted with money. And if you want to get a grant, you have to stay in the groove of whatever the theme is. And governments are working very closely with non-profits, like the Wellcome Trust is now just huge, sort of Bill and Melinda Gates size in terms of how much research it funds. I think it actually might be bigger. And so when those folks decide, as they have, these are the half dozen themes, if you make a proposition that's against one of those themes or in a different track, you just simply won't get any money. And if you publish a personal opinion about one of those tracks or directions that's counter to their intent, you will have the funding plug pulled permanently. And people know this, it's explicit. I have a friend who's a professor at a minor university in UK who was alongside me for a few months and then just quit. And he said, look, we've been told we're literally not allowed to contradict the government's messages, even though they're clearly mad. And if I do that, they'll cut the funding. And that will be the end of the department, not just me, but 30 staff underneath me. So that's what's happened. And medicine, I'm afraid doctors have been, they've had the time trimmed from whatever it was, 11 minutes per patient. I think it's 7 or 8 now. And by the time you've said hello and goodbye and really tried to get to the heart of the matter, you've got time to write a prescription, which is the purpose. That's the entire purpose of the consultation, as far as the sort of whole system is concerned. And so I would recommend to people, unless you think the doctor's got a chance of diagnosing something that you can't work out, I'm not really sure why you're going, because you're not going to be well served. It's a sad position. You're right. But there you go. So that's where we are. We're in a dreadful position where the reputation of the medical community is historic and not earned at all now. Obviously, there are individual wonderful physicians, but the practice of medicine systematically is corrupt, awful.
I think it was John Ioannidis from Stanford who said that about 70 to 75% of all peer-reviewed papers are just junk.
Yeah, I think, probably he meant medical journals or biomedical journals, because he probably wasn't commenting on physics. But I think that's probably true. shockingly. Lots of things, even in research. I remember there being a furore at Pfizer, so in the mid-noughties, 2005-7, something like that, when a paper came out from somewhere in the States which showed that a very large percentage of the findings, really important papers, and they went to about 20 important papers, and they had a research team try to reestablish the methods and then evaluate the question. And I think most of the time they couldn't, they could not replicate the findings that were thought to be seminal turning points in immunology, oncology, and so on. And so I'm not saying they were cheating, not at all. They might have been, but it's just the testing is, the methods have become so esoteric and so far off what is established that it's hard to know whether it's believable strictly. And of course, the more specialist the methods used become, the harder it is for someone like me, who's not going to be an expert in anything anymore, but you know, pretty broad scientist. I just can't even evaluate what they've done. And a very large amount to do with genetic manipulation belongs to that category, where people have inferred functions from certain proteins by looking at the impact of genetic manipulation, say in an animal or in a tissue. And then they've drawn some diagram of interactions, you know, intercellular pathways. And I'm looking at it thinking, well, that's one way of describing, but is that really how it works? But it affects target selection in my industry. It's like, well, if the pathway to inflammation is like this in these tissues under this circumstance, then an inhibitor here or an antagonist of this receptor there could be a good medicine. And that might be all the evidence we've got. And then the program starts and you end up with a molecule that's meant to interact with that target. Off they go to clinical trials. So just imagine the pressures to get, quotes, the right result, very, very high. I personally think the industry, I knew during my whole career, pharmaceutical industry was like a clockwork spring running down, by which I meant we had collectively identified the most druggable targets, that is, targets which, when struck with a small molecule, something you can eat, rub on your skin, inhale, drop in your eyes, and there are constraints around the design of those molecules. If they're too big or too polarized, they simply won't get absorbed or be removed too quickly. So the druggable chemical space is rather small. And what was wonderful is that what nature uses well, which is neurotransmitters and other local hormones that are released from one cell and act on a receptor on another cell, that plus certain enzymes have provided 90% of drugs, and almost all of the drugs that came from nature, you know, like opiates and stuff like that. And during my career, I became aware we'd almost run out. And the targets, in my view, were of diminishing quality. That is confidence in the rationale, confidence that you could get a selective molecule, confidence that it would bring about the effect sought without making your legs drop off. And so I've come to the conclusion, which is a bit shocking, that if I had the power to do it, I would close the large pharmaceutical companies and only allow generic manufacturers to have, you know, free rein. They would be highly regulated. Prices would be driven right down. Now, you might say, well, Mike, well, where would all the new drugs come from? It's just, do you know what? There's not been that many. Have been some. There's not been that many important new drugs. So if I was to weigh on the one side, the certainty we wouldn't get, you know, new breakthrough drugs, but we would use the ones we've got already, which are like a litter on the forest floor. They've dropped from the trees and they've gone through patent life, and now we can crunch around on them and just pick the best ones. I think if you spent all the money on proper doctoring and proper use of the medicines that most safely and effectively address the symptom or cause, and not the ones you're being incentivized to sell because they're expensive and new, I think the sum total of human happiness would be increased. So I wouldn't say I'd stop research-based new drugs, but I'd say, as a statement, I would just close them all, massively reduce medical costs, keep using the best of the generics, and let's rebuild from there. That's what I would do. Sorry, Pfizer. I could justify it. Yeah, go on.
No, I was going to say, I had the great pleasure of chatting to Lehman McHenry. I think you might know him, from California State University. And he wrote an incredible book called The Illusion of Evidence-Based Medicine. And it's basically confirming what you just said.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, for example, when you're running a clinical trial, and we can just turn back very quickly to the vaccines, you have to choose an endpoint. You'll choose a primary endpoint, the one on the basis of which, if it's moved significantly, you would say the study was a success or not. And you might have some secondary endpoints. What they chose in the vaccine, the COVID-19 vaccine trials, was to become infected as judged by a positive, PCR test, whether or not symptomatic. Now, that's just monstrous, because those PCR tests using this method they're not reliable, they're not trustworthy, never have been. Seriously, folks, all else being true, if you turn up the number of cycles of amplification, you'll have a higher percentage of so-called positive results than if you have a lower number of cycles of amplification. Well, what's the right number? I've never seen a single serious attempt, intellectually or practically, to work out where the crossover should be. Should we have no more than 20 cycles so that obviously infected people would come up positive? But people who are mostly, in my view, this is staying with the old narrative, the people who were positive at higher numbers almost certainly were not infectious. And they almost certainly weren't ill as a result of the burden of this material that they had. So, but here you go. The whole clinical trial pivoted on this primary endpoint using an unreliable, untrustworthy endpoint. And then, unfortunately, it was even worse than that because, and this is well known, so it's not my allegation. It's been alleged by, amongst others, Brooke Jackson, who was a clinical trial coordinator or whatever for three of the sites in the Pfizer trial. Peter Doshi, deputy editor of the British Medical Journal, pretty famous journal, who both point out that the number of patients who, before statistical analysis, when the study was complete, before their data was sent for statistical analysis, you comb through those individual reports to check, did the patient comply with the protocol? And if they didn't, it's a protocol violation. And then there'll be an algorithm that you use to decide whether, despite the protocol breach, should you allow the patient's data to go forward or not. So, for example, you might be required as a volunteer to speak once a week to your clinical trial coordinator, anytime between 7 p.m. Sunday to 6:59 the following Sunday. Say you called 3 minutes late. That's a protocol violation, absolute. But in discussions, I'm sure when you're working out the algorithm, you'd say that's fine. But if they didn't call till Tuesday, and you were asking them, for example, questions of symptoms today and your recollection of worst symptoms over the last week, that protocol violation would destroy that subject's data. So, and so where is this going? If you look at the number of subjects whose data was excluded for unspecified protocol violations, it was massively imbalanced. So it should have been like 20,000 on placebo and 20,000 on active, but there was like three times as many were excluded from prior to statistical analysis than in the other. That is impossible, because the people who are making that selection should have been blind to the treatment. Consequently, it's not possible for protocol reasons for them to have had different failures. But they did have different failures. And I remember when I read that, I thought they've cheated, literally just cheated.
I just have to quickly do my last ad break before we come in for the landing. So I'll be back with you now.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th.
With his expert analysis and opinion,
this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
In a race critical to GOP hopes of regaining control of the United States Senate next January, former Nevada Attorney General Adam Laxalt is leading incumbent Democrat Senator Catherine Cortez Masto 47-43%, with 4.5% remaining undecided in the latest Trafalgar poll of likely voters. Laxalt, the son of former New Mexico Senator Pete Domenici and grandson of former Nevada Governor and U.S. Senator Paul Laxalt, is seen as one of the GOP's best hopes at flipping a seat from Democrat to Republican. Meanwhile, next door, GOP Senate nominee Blake Masters is reminding Arizonans of Democrat incumbent Senator Mark Kelly's racist joke 4 years ago when he said of his twin brother, former astronaut Scott Kelly, that he was DNA challenged, half a howler monkey, half an orangutan, and that they had changed his name to Rodrigo. Really? Rodrigo? Why Rodrigo? From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Since the day I stopped drinking, my life has gotten better and better. I can't take any credit for it. It just seems that without alcohol, I think better, I'm more careful with money, I watch what I say, I don't get into trouble like I did when I was drinking. It's scary trying to walk through life alone, and today I have that very distinct feeling that I don't ever have to be alone again.
Visit AA.org for more information and download the Meeting Guide app to find a meeting near you.
Today's News Talk Radio.
Back to the phones. Hello, I hate your guts.
I hate you too.
What's your name?
Spit.
All right. I hate society.
TNT.
I haven't heard that ad before.
Very good.
That is a great ad. Mike, so we've got about 10 minutes left, and I like to try and find the silver lining. So the last 2.5 years have been very dark for many, many people. And I'm convinced that every cloud has a silver lining. Do you have such a cloud near you?
I do. Funnily enough, I've always been kind of non-conformist, shall we say, in lots of ways, which is probably why I'm speaking out, even though I had an ordinary or normie career. I've always been quite difficult, really. And I have to say, I have the same on-off relationship with God. And I would say over the last 3 years, my faith's been strengthened greatly. Just the number of good people that I've met, number of coincidences and so on. So I do think in the end, good will triumph over evil. However, if you look back over history, that has not stopped, you know, Pol Pot, Stalin, Mao, Hitler and so on. So I do not feel optimistic about the next few years. I do believe, however, that these absolute mad, you know, diabolical people, if that's what they are, that are seeking to take over humanity and subject it to totalitarian control for whatever purpose they want have in mind, they will not, I do not believe they will succeed, but I'm afraid I do think they're going to make a hell of a mess of the garden en route to salvation. But the people, for example, that are closest, who live closest to nature, you know, people who tend crops and animals, have their own water supply and so on, that they're not going to go down, because this bunch of cowards, because that's what they are, this bunch of cowards intends to control every person remotely using computer databases, high-speed internet, and mobile phones. So cashless central bank digital currencies, which could be here very soon in months rather than years, from that point onwards, you can only spend their beneficence. You can only spend where they let you as well. So once cash is gone and all money is digital, I, you know, at that point, I'm not sure, Jeremy, I'm not sure I can see a way out of that. So I keep selling people, you must reject mandatory digital ID for any purpose, and you must fight like hell not to allow the executive to remove cash. There's no legitimate reason to remove cash. Don't give me fraud. There's more fraud. There's more white-collar fraud using electronic money transfers than ever with cash. So there's no reason to get rid of cash, but it is our last grip on anonymity and genuine choice. So, I think they won't succeed because they won't, their madcap scheme will not capture everybody. And that there'll be enough people who are you know, in the system, like here right now in Florida, who, when the net comes down, decides, do you know what, I will trust my chances to be somewhat off-grid and reject the necessity of having, say, mandatory digital ID, or simply not do the things that I would require it to do. And I think there'll be enough people, I don't know what percentage it is, even if it was only 10%, that's like 700 million people, they're not going to kowtow to it. Okay, there is a possibility that the lunatics could then turn, you know, well-paid mercenaries out to go and find them all. But yeah, I think it's too difficult to maintain the level of control that they're going to need when they start squashing us. At the moment, we are self-centering mostly. And that's because two things. One is people don't want to do things that are inconvenient to themselves, and they don't want to embarrass themselves. And then finally, I think most people, because they're good people, they don't believe evil is real. You know, they just don't, they, funnily enough, they read the history books, but they don't believe it could possibly happen now for some reason. And so they don't take my warning seriously. Literally, it's like shrug. It's like, no, that can't be happening. Yeah, I think it is. So anyway, that's what I hope. Best case is they don't succeed. Better case would be they don't smash everything up, but they nearly have. For example, I think that there is the ongoing demolition of the modern economy and modern world. Fake emergencies are being used to maintain control measures. And like I said, if at any point Catherine Austin Fitz is a great lady to listen to, you know, if the executive chooses to say, for example, woe is me, I can't pay the sovereign, there's a sovereign currency, a sovereign debt crisis, which has happened before. They might be inching towards that with sterling as a test case. And so if we raise interest rates, the market, they lose confidence. And sterling falls. And if we don't raise rates, confidence falls, and so does the sterling. So I could imagine a sterling crisis at any moment. And at that point, they might say, look, the only thing we can do is like restart under one of these IMF, something like that. And this time, no cash, it'll all be digital. That way we can provide commitments to the lenders. And people might breathe a sigh of relief, even though I believe per Cyprus, there will be substantial haircutting of as they go from old pounds to, you know, new digital currency. But if we get to that point, Jeremy, I don't actually see a way out. That's quite, and I think people like Martin Armstrong, who's a very famous kind of unconventional economist, he's talking about possibly first quarter of next year.
I agree with you, hopefully, Mike. Yeah. Well, I mean, you're right. Catherine has been speaking about that, and so has Martin. We've got 5 minutes left, and I think I want to tell you just a heartwarming, very quick anecdote, if that's okay with you. He has a silver lining that I discovered. I was in 2020. I was very reliant on paroxetine, which is a antidepressant, as well as a proton pump inhibitor called omeprazole. So I was taking these two scheduled drugs. I found myself becoming so cynical and suspicious of the medical industry that I basically cold turkeyed over a space of a month, and I am now healthier than ever.
Wow. Yeah, I believe you. I remember one of the first lectures I had in pharmacology 41 years ago, and the pharmacy lecturer said, would you like a guess, anybody? What's the average number of prescription drugs given to a person in hospital? So an inpatient, we all guessed like 3 or 4. It was 11. Wow. And he said, you know, three of them on average, this is 1981 and presumably a survey from the 70s. He said, you know, about 3 of them are being given to counteract the side effects of some of the others. And that's so, incredible. You know, I don't disagree with you. I think that mostly, and of course, we've never studied those, or rarely. Most of them are not formally studied. We've no idea what the interaction of drugs 2 through 7 are with number one. So, and you think, well, and why would we trust an organization or whatever, a system that has lied and treated us so badly? So, I don't say to everybody stop taking your drugs; that would be reckless. But certainly think about whether you need all, whether they're all helping you, and how confident are you? And if your doctor says so, how do they know?
Mike, I'm running out of time, so I want to quickly ask, where can I follow you?
I've been very casual about this. I mean, I don't have my own website. I don't even write on Substack, so it's quite awkward. You can find me, but you have to go to Telegram, and you have to search for my friend's name, Robin Manotti, MONO. TTI plus Dr. Mike Eden. So I don't know whether you can find me, but you know, think about 115,000 people honor me by reading my comments. I usually make comments like between 2 and 10 times a day on us, either on a news item or thought I've had or a scientific paper or official data, and I'm relentlessly beating the drum. And this is what I would like to finish with: I cannot save you, and Jeremy cannot save you, and Peter McCulloch cannot save you. I can't even save myself. So if you hear any of this stuff, and you've heard it maybe for months or even years, I have to ask you, what have you been doing to communicate these messages to the people in your network? The reason I ask is I can never reach those people. The government's never going to tell them the truth. So, folks, listener, dear audience, if you don't go and tell them, they're never going to find out and we will lose. But if even a minor, not a low proportion of people go, okay, I can't do all of it because it's some of it's sciencey, but I can, I remember what he said about whatever it is,
yeah,
that I can go forward with that. Go and persuade people. And don't, if they shout at you,
yes,
just say, put your hands up and walk away. Try another person, down another person. You might find, if you get to the end of the day and you've woken three people up, my God, if everybody did that,
yes,
we'd win, Mike, very quickly.
I've got to go. I've got to go. We have to go to the news. Listen, Mike Eden, thank you for joining me in the trenches. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Luke, for keeping everything going. And thank you, everybody, for listening. My name is Jim. This is Jim Warfare, the Battle of Ideas on TNT Radio.